But right now, we're not wrapping up. We're going to talk FOOD. It is time for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, who joins us here on a Monday morning. Good morning there, Arthur.
Good morning, and Happy New Year almost for Jews.
That's it, yeah.
It starts Friday night, and it's all colliding for me. I don't know. I have to ask Jill what's in the stars here, but, you know, with the new year, my sister moving from the house she's lived in for over 40 years, big house with an attic and a basement, and me inheriting an enormous quantity, an overwhelming number of things from my youth and my grandmother's youth. I have, for instance, I don't know if the kids do this anymore. When you graduated from everything, you had an autograph book. Did you have autograph books?
Autograph books, and up and through eighth grade, believe it or not, there was a gold when I was a little baby, gold little shoes, and then when I graduated eighth grade, also bigger gold shoes that my grandmother made.
Gold?
Well, no, painted gold.
Oh, okay, no, because I have my first shoes were bronze.
No, these weren't bronze.
They did that in those days.
These were painted.
These were actual. I have them right here. I'm looking at them. They're on my desk. My bronzed first shoes. Well, anyway, the big for me. Well, there were a lot of treasures as well as annoying things, and too many pictures. But among the treasures is a pot that I have been looking for. Well, I gave up looking for it. But I did look for it for a long time, and then finally said, after I'd been through everything in this apartment and two storage rooms, that I must have lost it in a move. I couldn't imagine ever giving it away. Now you want to know what it is? My grandmother's gefilte fish pot. And it's a wherever aluminum pot. What they used to, I don't think they make this kind of pot anymore. It's a deep roasting pan with a cover that is almost as deep as the roasting pan itself. I'm not sure why it's called a roasting pan. You know what? Well, I'm not sure this phone that I'm on will go as far as the closet where this
Give it a shot.
I'm giving it a shot. I meant to get it out of my closet before I got on the air, and then I forgot because I want to see what they actually call it. In any case, it's big enough to make gefilte fish for a week, for a horde. It's called an oblong roaster. It's wherever a subsidiary of Alcoa, wherever aluminum, as I said, it's called an oblong roaster. But nobody that I know roasts in a pan like this anymore.
Question.
And in
question.
In fact, I don't think my grandmother ever roasted in this pan. It was strictly for gefilte fish.
How deep is it? Because it sounds like my grandmother's
brisket
pan.
Oh, I don't want to go back and measure it. I just left the room.
All right.
But it's deep. It's like it's at least 6 inches deep.
I swear that's the brisket pan.
And the top is at least 4 inches deep. So altogether, we're talking 10 inches.
Yeah.
You know a pan? I guess you could fit a turkey in there.
Could you fit a brisket? I swear that's my grandmother.
A brisket? No, that's not a pan for a brisket. But yeah, of course you could fit a brisket in there.
My non-cooking.
I guess you could put a brisket in there.
I bet you anything that was my mother's brisket pan.
Well, this is, I always called this the gefilte fish pot because I think that's all my grandmother ever used it for. And it was one of my jobs to go to the basement in our house in Marine Park. We lived in a two-family house, my immediate family on the top floor, my grandparents underneath us. And in the basement, there were storage closets, and I had to haul up. That was, it was my job to go down and get the gefilte fish pot. So, you know, this was a thing where you made a huge bed of fish bones and heads and carrots and celery and onion, and covered it with water and brought it to a boil and cooked it so you had some flavor out of all those vegetables and bones and heads. And then separately, of course, you were making the gefilte fish itself, which was the ground flesh of the fish. We always use whitefish and pike. A lot of people add carp. Carp, there's also 100% carp gefilte fish. Carp is let's just call it a lesser fish than whitefish and pike.
What's whitefish?
Whitefish is whitefish.
It comes
from the Great Lakes.
And it's called
Russia, but it's a freshwater fish.
And it's called a whitefish? It's
called whitefish. It's one word.
Huh.
Well, you must know this. There's smoked whitefish in every appetizing store.
Absolutely. I love it. I just always learn something new every day. I always thought
you didn't know that it was the actual name of
correct.
The fish.
I thought it was white the same way.
Was any kind of whitefish.
Right.
No, it's not. It's whitefish.
Now I know.
So don't get me started, because I could do this with tuna fish, too. Is it tuna or is it tuna fish? Some people say it's only tuna fish when it comes out of a can. Otherwise, it's tuna. I'm back to gefilte fish. Her patties, my grandmother's patties, the fish force meats, whatever you want to call them, rissole in French. They're very closely related to quenelle, quenelle, which is a French fish dumpling. So it just had carrots. It had vegetables all ground up, but not a lot. It was mostly fish, and it was the process that made it an ordeal. Well, it made it a big deal.
I like ordeal.
The process involved first grinding the fish. Buying the fish, which was an excursion to the old neighborhood.
I'm laughing. The word excursion. People don't use excursion enough. But I always remember going on.
Well, they don't take excursions unless they're on a cruise ship.
Right.
Then they call all those outings excursions. Anyway, so first, of course, go buy the fish, which was a half a day, because we had to go across Brooklyn and to my grandmother's old fishmonger. And then she selected her fish from the tank. They were live fish. And we brought it home and immediately started work, which was to say boning the fish, making the broth, and then grinding the meat of the fish, first in a meat grinder, which was hooked on to a chair. Only now in my adulthood do I understand why I was always the one who had to crank from my youngest age, how I had to crank the grinder, because to bend over
right.
a chair, why they didn't design these grinders with more space between the actual feeder tube and the base, I don't know. But you can't just hook it on a table and put a bowl underneath. It's got to be, I don't know. So we always had it on a chair. Anyway, after it's ground, and by the way, these grinders in those days, they weren't so sharp, they weren't electric. You really had to take the thing apart a few times, because
everything
skin or something
in
would get
I know.
Stuck in there because you weren't thorough enough to begin with. After that, it had to be chopped. And the chopping was essential, because my grandmother couldn't explain this to you. She just knew it had to be chopped until it came to a certain consistency. Chopping it works up the protein in the fish and makes it all stick together. And a lot of cheap gefilte fish is made with filler, made with some kind of starch to hold it all together. But we didn't put any starch in our gefilte fish. All right, well, I haven't made gefilte fish in years, but now that I have the pot, I may be inspired. I'm contemplating this. Depends on the weather this week, which is not going to be conducive to keeping a fire on for several hours. Actually, this pot has to go over two burners.
Right.
I
wish you'd take a picture of that pot. So when does Russia...
I could furnish you with a picture, but what you had one in your past also?
That's what I'm really thinking, that this was first my grandmother's brisket. Yes, yes.
Brisket pot. It could well be a pot for brisket, because
And it was it's,
brisket. You don't roast either. You know, you it's really
put it
great.
In there, and then they always because again, I've frequently used
and
this
being
word.
Heavy aluminum. By the way, this is a nice heavy aluminum.
Yep.
I think aluminum after copper, aluminum is
conducts.
The best conductor. So
right.
Don't stick your nose up at aluminum. really good stainless steel has a thick aluminum core. Because stainless is a terrible conductor in itself. In any case, you could easily make a brisket in here. But you know what? I'm not feeding an army anymore either. That's another issue with me. Lately, I've been cooking too much food, and then we end up eating the same thing for 3 days. I don't think I want to do that right now.
Does Bob, Mr. Harnon probably doesn't mind that, though.
Not at all. He's
yeah.
totally, as you know, his astrological aspect, he's totally into routine and never changing anything.
We share that. Now, just apropos, Rosh Hashanah is usually around the new moon. And so that...
Well, it must be a new moon then.
New moon's beginning.
Friday
but,
night.
But it's I've got Rosh Hashanah starting Saturday, Sunday night.
No, it's Friday night, sundown. It starts, so, yeah.
Well, that's...
And then it's also Saturday.
Then why...
Now, I think... Reformed Jews only celebrate one night. But
why does it say 10 and 11? I swear, everything I'm finding is...
Well, the 10th is the first full day, and then the 11th is the second full day.
Except that Saturday
but
is the
7th. But it starts on the 9th at sundown.
But the 9th is...
Because it's Jewish.
Okay.
It starts always. The day starts at sundown.
Okay, but the 9th is Sunday.
Shabbos starts on Friday at sundown.
That is true. That's the 7th.
The ninth, Friday is the 9th, isn't it?
No, it's the 7th.
Oh, am I making a big mistake here? Today is the 3rd.
Yes.
4th, 5th, 6th, 7th. You're right. I'm wrong. So the 9th is Sunday?
Yes.
Oh.
Just all right. For all of our listeners, which is great, just so that, yes,
well,
Shabbos.
I'm glad to know this. I don't know why I had it in my head that it started Friday night.
Because sundown
is Shabbos. I always dread when a Jewish holiday is on the Sabbath because you have to stay in shul even longer.
Forever.
there's even more prayers when it overlaps with the Sabbath.
I remember
so
when
I
discovered
to talk
that.
About the food, though. Let's talk about the food. So there's a dish that I was making, when I'm meaning in the past tense, active, because I made it a lot for a period, until I realized that, and it's chicken with tzimis. I'm sure I must have talked about it on the air because I was making it and loving it. I still love it, but I don't make it because if you're diabetic, which I am, although I am totally, don't worry anybody, I'm very under control. But I don't even check my blood sugar regularly anymore. My doctor said I don't need to. So I guess I'm at the edge. But in any case, one thing that will really set off your blood sugar is dried fruit. You know, except for like pure sugar. Even a piece of chocolate cake doesn't set me off nearly as much as a few prunes. And so this would be, and it has honey in it as well. So it's just, and it's called tzimis. Now, tzimis, when I was growing up, was mostly made with sweet potatoes, and sour prunes and a piece of meat, or it was made with carrots and also a piece of meat, and it was sweet, had either honey or just plain old sugar in it. Of course, if you make something with prunes and sweet potatoes, it's going to be sweet even without that, but you added that anyway. So and the thing about New Year's for rituals, food rituals, is that a sweet New Year is ensured by eating sweet foods. So even if you're not having something like a tzimis that is sweet by nature, most people have apples, because it's apple season, which you cut into wedges and dunk into a little dish of honey. In fact, they sell, you know, honey pots for Rosh Hashanah in any Judaica store. It's a nice item to own, and that's another thing I inherited from my sister's attic. Was my mother bought this little antique honey dish, and I just rediscovered it. But anyway, I loved Tzimis, and I discovered this particular one that I'm going to give you the recipe for at the home of a Kosher friend. She didn't make it for any holiday. It was just like a company dish, which it could be, and I had made it as a company dish. And the recipe itself comes from a book called The Gefilte Manifesto. The Gefilte Manifesto, written by Liz Alpern and her husband, Jeffrey Yoskowitz, is, they're a young, hip couple from Brooklyn, in Brooklyn, who are kosher, young family. And there are a lot of them, very food conscious or mindful, is a good word, mindful food people who happen to be kosher. Yoskowitz and Alpern happen also to raise in places outside the city, of course, or have raised, I should say, meat for the kosher market, range-fed beef, everything, the most green possible, and mindful, and this is their recipe. So my kosher friend served it to me and apologized that she didn't have the right pot for the dish, which is a really just a 10 or 12 inch black iron skillet, nothing hard to have. But my kosher friend said she doesn't have one that's fleshig. In other words, she only uses her black iron skillet for vegetarian and dairy-based dishes. Even if you use butter, in that pan, you cannot then cook chicken in it. So anyway, I have not only one, I not only have the perfect pan to make a portion for four, but I also have a black iron skillet that fits triple the recipe. So I have made this actually for company, and it's quite a show when you put it in this enormous, enormous black iron skillet. Most of it's cooked in the oven, not on top of the stove, but you do have to have a burner that will mine must be at least 14 inches, could be 16-inch pan. Anyway, but a normal-sized black iron skillet makes this for four. So here's the recipe. By the way, it's mostly cooked in the oven, even though you start it on top of the stove. So preheat the oven to 400 degrees, and then mix together what will be a glaze, because it is a sweet dish. It has sugar. And the glaze consists of 3 tablespoons of grated, peeled, fresh ginger. That's a nice big hunk of fresh ginger root. 4 or 5 inches probably reduces down to 3 tablespoons grated. If you get a little more out of that, that's fine too. 3 tablespoons of honey, any honey you love. 2 tablespoons, 2 tablespoons, 1 tablespoon of vegetable oil. 2 teaspoons of salt. And here's a tricky ingredient, red pepper flakes. I don't always have people who love heat, so I don't put in the full measure of a half a teaspoon. I'm more likely to put in a quarter of a teaspoon. You need a little hotness here because you want to balance out the sweet, plus a teaspoon of grated lemon zest. So that's your little glaze. The chicken, 2.5 pounds of chicken thighs I use. You can use, if you like, breast, then make chicken pieces, 2.5 pounds of chicken pieces, with the skin, bone in, the whole deal, and brown them in your heavy skillet with another tablespoon of oil. Heat the oil in your black iron skillet. Place the chicken in the pan, skin side down, and without moving the chicken, except to maybe shake a little so it doesn't stick. It won't stick, really. If your pan is very hot and your oil is very hot, and cook it until it's browned. It's going to take about 7 minutes, I find, at the right heat, which is not Your black iron skillet, by the way, is not the most even heater. And I find if you're cooking towards the edge of the pan, you get the max heat. For one thing, you get the reflective heat of the side of the pan. And so, you know, after a few minutes, juggle the pieces around a little bit. And at some point, you might even want to turn them over. But mainly, you want to get a nice brown piece of chicken. So when they're like that, just put them in a bowl and pour over your glaze and just set it aside. Now, to the same pan where you cook the chicken, you're going to add some onion. I would say medium to medium-large onion cut into half-moon slices. Can be thin. I like thin. Excuse me. A whole pound of carrots. Excuse me. I don't usually do that on the radio.
When it happens, it happens. Whole pound of carrots.
Know.
Are they?
Like, we used to have a sneeze control, but I don't. Anyway,
you got a phone.
So
do you
a pound
do the carrots?
Of carrots. So I'm throwing the onion into the pan, and while that starts sauteing, I'm cutting my carrots into half inch rounds and throwing them in the pan. It's all about 3 cups, maybe a little more than 3 cups of onion. And now you add the essential sweet ingredient, a half a pound of pitted prunes. Now the actual recipe calls for them being coarsely chopped. I didn't like that idea because I didn't want them to melt down. I wanted pieces. So I take a scissor and I cut them in half. That's about as far as I'll go.
Okay.
So in this skillet now you have the onion sautéed a couple minutes, the carrots, and you're going to sauté them for about 10 minutes, and adding your salt and half pepper flakes. And then add about a half a cup of water. Actually, I find the recipe says a half a cup, but I think more like 3/4 of a cup of water to the skillet. And scrape up whatever is stuck to the skillet. And now place the chicken skin side up. You're now nicely browned skin side up on top of this mixture of prunes and carrots and onion. And drizzle, you know, scrape out that bowl where the chicken was because there's probably going to be glaze stuck in the bowl and you want every drop of it. And you put this skillet in the oven, uncovered, this is a 400-degree oven, for at least a half an hour, could be 35, 40 minutes even. I don't like very, 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 very well-done chicken, but, you know, chicken thighs, they need to be thoroughly cooked. So I would say 35 minutes. And if you're going to serve it right away, at least let it rest for 10 minutes. But you can also reheat this. So everybody who makes a big dinner or even a not-so-big dinner on Rosh Hashanah wants to know if they can do it ahead. What can I say? So, yes, you can do this ahead and reheat it gently, either in the oven. There's a lot of juice here, so you could take some of the juices and baste the chicken and put it back in the oven. And if there's not a lot of juice, by the way, you can add a little water as the thing goes. You know, and check it after 15, 20 minutes and see if there's enough liquid in the bottom of the pan. It's a really good dish. So with that, you don't need much. Would be nice to have something green, I guess. I don't know. This time of the year, if you really want what's growing, it's Swiss chard, which I've been eating a lot of.
Do you put one of my favorites is a little bit of lardon or pancetta and chopped up Swiss chard? And
yes, but not for Rosh Hashanah.
I understand.
I'm not eating pork. I eat pork, but
No.
I'm making a Rosh Hashanah. You know what I would make with this? I'd make my famous potato kugel, which is in my book, Arthur Schwartz's Jewish Home Cooking.
Which is right here.
That has a little story. Pardon me?
Which is right here.
Which is right there. Good, good. I can give you the ingredients because we don't have a lot of time. But just to say, the secret to this potato kugel is a huge number of eggs. It calls for a dozen eggs. Let's say it also serves 12 to 16 people. So we're not talking about like a really egg-rich thing, but it is an egg-rich thing. I have reduced the eggs lately to 10 eggs, and it still comes out great. So if a dozen eggs scares you, you know you can reduce it to 10. And it calls for 3 pounds, important, russet baking potatoes, because russets, I don't want to go into the details, but they're the best for this kind of dish. And how you handle the potatoes is all important. You peel them, and I do them in the food processor, fitted with the metal blade, and I first do my onion. So for 3 pounds of russets, I use 2 medium onions, 12 ounces of onions, cut into chunks, and I do the onion first, almost puree, put that in the bowl, and the reason I say this is it helps keep the potatoes from turning gray. They may be a little pink, but they won't be gray. So then you do the potatoes, and when you have them ground, we're no bigger than a grain of rice, you drain the potatoes and throw out that water, just squeeze them in a strainer with the back of a rubber spatula and add those to the onions. And your seasoning is a tablespoon of salt, at least 3/4 teaspoon of freshly ground black pepper. I like mine peppery, so I would do a whole teaspoon. And 2/3 cup of matzo meal. Don't use flour. It really makes a gummy potato pudding. The other trick to mine is matzo meal. And then the fat. I don't put any fat inside the pudding, but I do put 2 tablespoons in my 12 by, what's the size of the baking dish, the standard 13 by 9-inch baking dish, and pour in the batter. The batter, the fat, and I love to use melted chicken fat with this. I couldn't find chicken fat last time I made it, so I bought, which you can find, D'Artagnan is a brand, D'Artagnan duck fat. Boy, was this good with duck fat.
Yeah.
So you do 2 tablespoons melted in the bottom of this dish. You pour in the batter. It's going to come up into the corners, the oil. So press down with the back of a spoon, press down the batter so that it gets into the corners more. And it's okay for the oil to come up over the top, which you want, in fact, to put yet another tablespoon of fat on top. But just note, there are only 3 tablespoons of fat in this enormous thing. Cook it at 350, uncovered. It's going to take at least 1 hour and 15 minutes. This is, I must say, reheats extremely well. So you let it rest before you serve it, or make it the day before and reheat it in a 350-degree oven until it's heated through.
That sounds yummy.
It'll only get crispier at the edges.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
That's a good one. Marshall is saying hook. But
all right. All right. I'm not making that, though, in 99-degree weather.
I understand.
We're actually having a party here today, but I'm not cooking for it. It's a dessert party, and all the dessert is done already.
Oh, that's clever.
All right.
Well, it wasn't clever, but...
yeah, it was.
It's a birthday, you know.
All right. We will talk to you
all
next
right.
week. And Happy New Year.
Everybody, keep cool, and don't celebrate Rosh Hashanah when I said it was, because it's not Sunday.
All right.
Take care. Bye.
Arthur Schwartz, the food maven, here on Robin Hood Radio, robinhoodradio.com. Providing support for Arthur Schwartz, the food maven from Hathaway Young, located on South Center Street in Millerton, Flawless Catering and Event Planning, HathawayYoung.com. John Andrews Restaurant on the Hillsdale Road in South Egremont, 413-528-3467. On the web, jarestaurant.com. Rubiner's Cheesemongers and Grocers on Main Street in Great Barrington, 413-528-0488, Rubiner's.com. In Hillsdale, New York, Hillsdale Home Chef with 2 beautiful teaching classes, and they've got classes to go in those cooking rooms. More information, 518-325-7000, hghshomechef.com. And Haven Cafe in Lenox, Massachusetts, offering quality food and excellent service. From a fresh cup of great coffee to healthy, delicious breakfast, or sit down with a dinner with a tasty, life-enhancing meal that you can take home. Also, they feature catering. Supporting local organic farmers, environmentally conscious, and epicurious distributors, havencafebakery.com.